Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Joining me today as co-host is associate producer Taylor Lanzett. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, Jenna.
We've got a great show today.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
I know, because we're interviewing Mark Bittman. Mark, for those of you who don't know, has done nearly everything food related. He's a food system journalist and a cookbook author. His weekly column, which I'm sure you all have read, in the New York Times, was The Minimalist, which he did for 13 years. And he is the author of the ubiquitous cookbook, How to Cook Everything, which is on every home cook shelf.
Yeah, it's on my bedside table too.
I know. It's the best. Okay. After leaving the New York Times, he became the chief innovation officer at Purple Carrot, which is a plant-based meal service, a meal delivery service company. And most recently, he transitioned to academia, joining the faculty at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Mark, you have a new cookbook out, How to Bake Everything, which seems like a departure from your previous cookbooks because baking is more of an exact science, right? And I find the beauty of your other cookbooks to be that you kind of teach the technique and then provide a lot of variations. So what was the process like for creating this new book, and why did you decide to do a book on baking?
For me, baking is a subset of cooking, and this notion that baking is science and cooking is art is, I wouldn't say it's nonsense, but it makes things much more complicated than they need to be. And while it's true that there's more measuring in baking than there needs to be in most cooking,
yeah,
it's equally true you can improvise in baking, you can learn how to do things and then take liberties, and it's also true that a lot of cooking is quite exact also. So, as I said, baking is a subset of cooking. It is a somewhat more technical subset, but like everything else I do, I'm going to look at the simplest side of things, the most accessible side of things, and try to make it even simpler and more accessible. So, to me, it was a different kind of challenge, but it was not radically different. It's not as if I decided suddenly to write a book about auto repair. It seems akin to me to the other How to Cook Everything books, and it's very much in the same spirit.
I think that for me, baking sounds like a departure because I'm always worried about measuring stuff. But I'm definitely happy to know that you can kind of like learn a few basics and then go from there.
Even in the cooking community, right? There's such a divide between the pastry folks and otherwise. So it's also prevalent when you see it on a menu. You're like, oh, this person specializes in this, and this person specializes in that.
Well, it's true. There's no soup chef in a kitchen.
Yeah.
And there is a pastry chef, but everybody's working towards the same goal. Everybody's using similar ingredients. Everybody's measuring to greater or lesser extent.
Yeah.
I mean, of course you can make an argument that baking is completely different, but I think it's a specious argument. I don't think it works.
As someone who still publishes cookbooks, obviously, do you think that the rise of food blogs, social media, and just kind of overall, like the internet, has changed your approach to writing cookbooks specifically?
Well, it hasn't really changed my... First of all, I've been writing cookbooks for 25 years.
When the internet still existed?
So it's hard to know whether the changes... You know, during that period of time, we went from not quite pre-internet, but almost pre-internet to now.
Yeah.
It's hard to know what changes are a result of the web and what changes are a result of just my evolution and the evolution of the cookbook world and cooking in general. So it's hard to separate it out. But really, the process for me is the same. The books have changed. I like to think they've changed for the better. And I don't sit around saying, I could stop writing entirely and say, look, there are 50 bazillion recipes online. Why does anyone need
a
more
book
from me? I've written alone 20,000. Who needs anything else from me? And yet the books feel different for me. They feel like an advancement. They feel like I'm moving forward, and people keep buying them. So it's clear there's something to offer. It's also been true as the book industry in general has died and then seemingly come back to life. During that whole period, cookbooks continued to sell pretty well. So there is something people like about having a book, a physical paper book in their hands. And, I think that's true of novels and nonfiction as well as instructional books like cookbooks. Someone said to me the other day, print is the new vinyl, which I thought was hilarious. But, you know, to some extent...
It's true.
It is true. It hasn't died. It's never going to be as strong as it was because, obviously, we do have e-books and so many of us do so much reading online or on tablets or phones or whatever. But books live. So.
Yeah. I'm one of those people who I collect cookbooks. And I think that Taylor and I were talking earlier and we said that, you know, how to cook everything. That was your first book, right? Your first cookbook?
No, my first cookbook was actually fish.
Oh, fish. Okay, got that wrong. We're going to edit that out, Mark.
It's really not fair because if you're allowed to be wrong, then I should be allowed to be wrong also.
Okay.
I mean,
deal.
If we have to edit out everything we say that we don't like, then, you know. Anyway, you do what you want. I'm just teasing.
Fair point. But still, how to cook everything is, required reading, bedside reading. It's on every cook's home cook shelf, certainly, mm-hmm. and still the gold standard. Actually, was the one of the first cookbooks I ever received, and the person who bought it for me is a big time food editor, you know, FCI grad, whatever. And he was like, "This is the only cookbook you need."
Well, that's really, that's really sweet. I don't think of it as bedtime reading myself, but I do remember when I was in my 20s. I certainly did read cookbooks in bed, and I know people still like to do that. So, great. If How to Cook Everything is in that mix, I'm ecstatic.
It is.
Mark, it came as a surprise to many when, in 2015, you announced that you would be leaving The Times for a leadership role with Purple Carrot, the plant-based meal delivery service. And, you know, there are so many innovative food and ag startups making meaningful changes to our food system. And we're wondering why you decided on a meal delivery company.
Sorry, well, we should have prefaced that by saying we're gonna shift gears.
I noticed.
Yeah.
I might take issue with the notion that there are so many food startups making meaningful changes in food and ag, but that is what I thought 2 years ago when I started thinking about joining one. I would say it was not for me. So, and in retrospect, I think this might be the first time I've said this publicly, but in retrospect, I think I was looking for a reason to leave the Times. I was really tired. I'd worked really, really hard for, depending on how you count, but any number of years. And it wasn't that I thought that Purple Carrot was going to be not work, and it certainly was work. But I just needed out. I needed a different kind of challenge than the challenge of weekly deadlines, weekly writing deadlines. And starting in the 80s and continuing until a couple of years ago, I almost never didn't have. Almost never did a week pass where I didn't have a deadline. And some weeks I had three or four. So,
it's a huge amount of pressure. And just to kind of come up with that much content, right? Deadlines aside.
Especially once I started writing opinion, because it's, you know, to come up with a recipe every week as I did in The Minimalist, you know, I didn't want to repeat myself. I wanted the recipes to be good. I wanted to range all over the place. Okay, I did that. But that's not the same as saying something out loud that's a strong opinion and wanting to be right. And the opinion column was much more stressful than anything I'd done before. Much more rewarding also, but I was just worn out.
Yeah. I'm just curious then sort of, you know, and pushing back against the notion that there are a lot of meaningful ag startups out there. What was it then about Purple Carrot that you were like, this is the next move for me? It you know, hits all this other criteria that other ones are not.
The notion that you could help people learn how to cook without meat was valuable to me,
and distinguishes
Purple Carrot from other meal kit companies. But frankly, I wanted to make sure that Purple Carrot was different in many other ways, ranging from sourcing to the way that we treated our workers to being pioneers in packaging, and so on. And that may well yet happen, but it wasn't happening fast enough for me when I was there.
And I think that those are questions that a lot of, you know, meal service delivery companies specifically are still kind of trying to figure out.
I don't know whether they're trying to figure them out or not. For all I know, they don't care, but they certainly haven't solved those issues.
Yeah. Okay, so we're kind of going in reverse order of your career in terms of some of the questions.
No, we're bouncing around. It's fine.
We're bouncing around. And I want to shift and talk a little bit about the column that you wrote, right? And you mentioned that you started to write more opinion pieces over the years about the food system, like behind the food that you were making, right? The policies behind the food. And in a lot of ways, like, you know, your column kind of followed the arch of how food dipped into the political discourse over the past 10 years. Was this a natural progression for you? And do you think that all people, if they're interested in food, starts to wonder about topics like where their food comes from over time?
Well, let me give very, very short answers first to that really terrific question, which would be a long conversation if we pursued it logically, and then we'll expand on them as much or as little as you like.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a logical progression for me? Yes, and I can talk about how that worked. Is it a logical progression for everyone? Well, it's not, but it would be great if it were, and it's a logical progression for many people. So, obviously, you want a little more than that.
So for you, we'll start with you.
Well, we'll start with me. I lived in Connecticut. I raised my kids there, and I saw Connecticut go from, a state that was a funny mix of suburban and really, really, really rural, and included still a fair number of farms when I first moved there in the 70s, to a place that was increasingly suburban and more forested and less agricultural. And as that was happening, I saw, and anyone else who was looking could also see, that food in the quality of food in supermarkets was declining, and it was less varied. And equally true, the quality of American diet was declining as well.
Mm-hmm.
From writing about food, from cooking all the time, from trying to buy food locally, which, you know, is not a... buying food locally, by the way, is not a new thing. Everyone who cooks has always tried to buy local food. Anyone who really cooks, because it's clearly...
It's fresher. Better.
Clearly inferior. It's clearly superior.
Yeah.
So from doing all of those things, it was clear to me that there was less local food. The food that there was wasn't as good. People were... having increasing diet problems, and nutritional advice wasn't super helpful.
Yeah.
And then came the sort of notion for me around the year 2000 came the notion that there wasn't enough meat on the planet for everybody to eat as much as they wanted to, nor was there ever going to be. It was a logical impossibility, and that in the long run, we were going to all be eating more plants.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I started work on how to cook everything vegetarian, which I started in about 98, 99, and was published, I don't know when, 2006 or 2007, I don't know.
Yeah, sometime.
Sometime. Well, I'm just trying to put this stuff in context.
Yeah, yeah.
And also in 99 or 2000, Eric Schlosser published Fast Food Nation, which is, you know, not... There are earlier books critiquing American food culture, but for our generations, right now, Schlosser's was the first, and it remains among the best. And it was really an eye-opener. And I put all that in sort of the Bittman blender. I started writing a little bit more about... aspects of food other than cooking, and then in 2007 I decided I would really jump into this with both feet, and I started writing policy pieces for the Week in Review section, which is now Sunday Review, and in the Times, and before long I was trying to convince the Times to let me write a weekly opinion column, and before long I did. So that's the progression. If you cook, I think you're going to see, you will, if you have cooked for the last 30 years, as I have, 40 years, you will have seen those changes. If you haven't, but you cook now or you continue to cook, you're going to wish that food was different than it is, if you're a principled person. So the more people that see this, the better, obviously, and the more people that see the interconnectivity or the web-like structure of society of which food is a part, that food affects the environment and labor and health and public health and climate change and so on, and all of those things affect food and all of those things affect each other, and that you can't talk seriously about fixing one aspect of the system without talking seriously about fixing the other aspect. I think food is a great gateway, a great entry drug into understanding the world, but you have to think things through and you have to look at them and try to see things as they really are. Once you do that, I think, I'm not saying it's obvious, but a thinking person can figure these things out.
Yes. That makes sense for me, right? Like, you kind of start to put the pieces together eventually by kind of like maybe reading cookbooks or do cooks talk about how local produce is better, and then that kind of starts sparking other questions. But I mean, do you think for like a just an everyday, you know, I don't know, like an ordinary person who just cooks a few times a week, do you think that's a natural progression, and like how do you encourage that in general, right, in all people?
I'm an ordinary person who cooks a few times a week. So I think the answer is yes. And how you encourage it is, for me, I encourage it by trying to include some political awareness in my columns and in my cookbooks, but also I went to work writing those columns. So that was my,
your foray, your
entry. It used to be my goal.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree that you are an average person and you can speak for yourself on this one. But even like this weekend, there was a Times article that came out that showed that, like, the number two item purchased by most U.S. households is still, like, sugary beverages and sodas.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Something.
Yeah.
And the number two, and this is a, you know, and
what's for, number one?
Pizza. Yeah. Oh. And right for
I definitely contribute to that, by the way.
For all of us, we're thinking this is a given at this point, right? Like, the conversation on drinking soda and sugary sweetened beverages is over. And I don't
well,
even
it
know
is on the
last
East Coast
one.
And the West yeah. Coast, right? I think that that maybe just speaks to the fact that we live in a bubble,
yeah.
probably, and on the coast. And maybe it's just not getting through yeah. to the rest of the public.
I guess I'm just interested to know, and I'm not sure if you have an answer here or thoughts, but it's really like, where do we get that natural progression where, right, the middle of the country is feeling this too, and the questions about knowing your farmer and knowing more about your food are just the given, right? You're learning about it in third grade, fourth grade. You're going home. You have homework assignments on it. Then you're talking to your parents about it.
I think that we're probably...
I don't know that I'd make the distinction, the typical coastal distinction versus middle of the country thing. There are people doing things better and worse everywhere, but...
Yeah.
That's probably my tendency to reverse snobbery, but I think that some people are going to recognize things because they look at them and they think about them, and some people are not, and that's why I'm in favor of regulations like soda tax, or why I'm in favor of limiting the marketing of junk food to children, because
yeah.
we have to teach people better as they're growing up.
Yeah.
What it means to eat real food. And soda and the things that are like it, which, you know, certainly include all sugar-sweetened beverages, but include a host of things sold in the supermarket and sold at fast food places that are nutritionally worthless or worse than nutritionally worthless. We need regulations that say... Yeah, you can't stop grown-ups from eating what they want to eat, but you can stop children from eating what they want to eat. And it's not just parental guidance. It's also limiting the marketing and limiting the sales of things that seem to be bad for us, to kids who can't make reasoned decisions.
Yeah.
And we all know that there isn't a person... I've said this, what I'm about to say, I've said 100 times in the last year, if I've said it once, and no one's ever disagreed with me. Feel free. But we all know that our habits, our desires, food-wise, are formed when we're very, very young. And we all know that we crave the stuff that we learned to crave when we were kids. And if the stuff we learned to crave when we're kids is not good for us, then it means we're doomed to a life of conflict, a life where we, and everybody I know acts and feels this way,
yeah.
a life where we crave certain foods and we think, oh, I shouldn't have that. And that actually leads to conflict, internal conflict and unhappiness. I mean...
Yeah, because you don't want to feel like you're denying yourself something, and
exactly,
we live in like a diet
exactly.
culture.
Like, you know,
yeah.
when you're tired...
You just want pizza.
Like, you might feel like, oh, I can't go to bed because that's an inconvenient time to go to bed. But
yeah.
for the most part, you think, oh, I'm tired, I'm going to go to bed. When you're hungry... you want to eat. That's fine. But what is it that you want to eat? Then you set up this conflict that actually makes you feel bad. And
yeah.
until we learn, until we teach our children what's right to eat and what's good to eat, they are going to grow up just as we grew up, which is craving foods that are not good for us.
Mm-hmm.
And every year that we delay marketing junk to kids means another year's worth of generations growing up with the same conflict, with mm-hmm. adults who have greater or lesser eating disorders.
Yeah.
I think it's really unfortunate.
So I'm going to be the first person to disagree with you on part of that. So I think that we interviewed Bea Wilson on her new book, First Bite, a few months ago, which was just a fascinating read. And the premise is basically that, yes, you're right, 100% that your food preferences are shaped very, very young in life. She talked about this new research coming out that food preferences are shaped even as early as 4 months. And so you should start feeding kind of, solid food pureed, basically, at that time, in addition to breastfeeding. But I think that to your larger point, which is also, she says that you can change your food preferences later in life. It just takes, it's a very kind of almost arduous process, right, of introducing the same types of food over and over and over again, even in small quantities, to really help reshape your palate. But to your point, in terms of what you crave, I think that that's the big takeaway, right? If you're hungry, do you really want to also eat a fresh salad in addition to what else? Like, do you want to eat those foods? So I would say overall, I agree, but just wanted to make that quick put in that plug. Okay, we're going to take a really quick commercial break right now and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we are going to be talking a little bit more about, of course, the 2016 election and what this means for food system advocates. Stay tuned.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right. Right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're talking with Mark Bittman.
Period. Full stop. Just talking to Mark Bittman. Amazing.
So, sort of jumping off your last point, Mark, if we all reflect on the 2016 election...
We have to talk about it.
We're a week away from a Trump administration.
Otherwise known as the apocalypse, for us, in our opinion.
Why do you think food, and even for the most part, conversations on the environment still remain untouched and left out of the conversation?
Well, it's a really tough question, and I spent a lot of energy in the last couple of years trying to change that.
Yeah.
And there were some indications that the Clinton administration was going to take food a little more seriously than the Obama administration did, and certainly then the Trump administration will, but it still was not going to be as central as we think it should be,
right,
speaking for you and me, even though we haven't discussed this. So why isn't that? Well, part of it has to do with the fact that the first primary is in Iowa, and Iowa is, you know, ground zero for industrial food production.
Yeah.
So that's a big issue.
Hmm.
Part of it is that I don't think they've thought this thing through. Part of it is that there isn't a public clamor to take on the food system. And then the question is, why isn't there a public clamor? And this goes back to part of the discussion we had before, but it also, I think it also speaks to the fact that for most Americans, something like 60 or 80%, whatever number you want to pick, there's not going to be a hard number on this, but for the majority of Americans, the food system works. For you and me, it works. We get to eat whatever we want, pretty much whenever we want it, and if we have enough money, we can get the highest quality food available. So it works for us. It works for people who don't want to eat particularly well because they like, many of them like the food that they're eating. It is affordable for most people, and it is omnipresent, and I think that's important. You don't have to think about food. You can go Almost no matter where you live in the United States at this point, within a half an hour, you can go buy almost any ingredient you want or find almost any cuisine you want. So in the, you know, in the relatively small cities of the Midwest, if you feel like having Thai food or even Indonesian food, you can do that.
Yeah.
If you feel like going to the supermarket and looking for exotic ingredients and cooking them, you can do that. And if you feel like going to the supermarket and buying a mango or an apple or any other fruit or vegetable you can name completely 100% out of season, you can do that. So I think for most people, the food is there. The food they want is there. It's here. It's affordable. And it's not, look, it's a pretty safe system. I mean, people don't get sick in the sense of throwing up or being poisoned all that often. They may get sick from overeating junk, but that's a long, slow process that
people don't want to recognize.
We're all lousy about taking, or most of us are lousy about taking good long-term care of our bodies.
Yeah.
So, here's something I say a lot. I've said a lot that no one agrees with, but I find it amusing, so I'm going to keep saying it, which is that I think food, to many people, is like football. You know that it's not good. You know that it needs a lot of work if it's going to stick around. But you, in the case of football, you watch it on Sunday anyway. And in the case of food, you eat what's around anyway. Because it's like easy and convenient, and for the most part,
people don't think about it.
I mean, let's remember that most people have forgotten how to cook or never learned.
Yeah.
And so going out and eating fast food, going out and eating restaurant food, is the only way they know to get spicy, tasty, let's say zesty, to use an old-fashioned word, food in their lives. Because so much institutional food is so terrible that going out to, you know, Sonic or McDonald's or a pizza place where the food actually has flavor, whether you like it or not, it does.
Yeah.
You know, is in some ways a welcome relief. So, you know, you think of buffalo wings. I mean, compared to the food of 30 years ago that people were going out and eating, it's really quite flavorful.
Right.
Is the word I want.
Absolutely. By the way, I totally agree with you about football. So
well, good. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we're on the same page about that one. So basically, people don't need to think about it so much anymore because we have so many choices. We can, for most Americans, not certainly for like 50 million people who rely on SNAP, but we maybe as a society, I don't know, don't care as much as we should about people. I think that's the social fabric in this country is rapidly deteriorating. That's a whole other conversation. But yeah, for a lot of people, like the food system, I guess, works as it is, and they are not forced to think about it all that much. And certainly food is ubiquitous, and any kind of food is ubiquitous. Okay, so I want to be cognizant of time, and I really want to get this two more questions in for you. And
okay,
sure. Oh, sorry. I thought I cut you off. Okay, so here it is. You're a food advocate. I'm a food advocate, obviously. But we live in a very crazy time right now. And I'm wondering, like, given the overall threats that a Trump presidency will entail, can we as food advocates, you know, no longer afford to be focusing on food system issues? Should we, as kind of general advocates, be narrowing our focus to something, to like other quote unquote bigger issues like the environment, like women's right to choose? I mean, things that we thought were settled decades ago. Do we need to consolidate our advocacy powers and energy to some of these other core topics as opposed to what some people might call a niche topic?
Such a great question. And again, something that would take, you know, it's a long conversation,
yeah,
but it is something I've given a lot of thought to. And I think the short answer is this. No, we should not stop thinking about food. But yes, we should be allied with people who think about all of the issues you just mentioned and more. And I think there's this notion that food is a nonpartisan issue, and certainly everybody eats. But, you know, that's like arguing that women's rights is a nonpartisan issue.
Yeah.
All women need rights. So, right, it's a nonpartisan issue. But some people are willing to pay attention and fight for these things, and some people are not.
Yeah.
And I think if you're willing to fight for women's rights, if you're willing to fight to counter climate change, if you're willing to fight for better food and for better environment and against racism and against poverty and for a better living for people and for national health care and on and on and on,
yeah,
then you're on the same side of this struggle and we should be fighting together. I don't think that that means that we give up talking about food. It may mean that there are some issues that we have, and I'm not going to go into this because I don't want to make enemies, but it may mean that there are some issues in the under the banner of food that are just not as important as others.
Yeah.
And we need to figure out what the most important issues are and look for our allies in all of those other movements who will agree with us on that. Say, for example, marketing of junk food to children, but whatever it turns out to be, and say, look, we'll show up at your marches, we'll go talk to your congressman, et cetera, with you. You come do that with us. We want to get antibiotics out of the food supply. You want to make abortion safe and legal.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to work together on both those things because then there's more of us. I think
both of which are public health issues,
like
by the way.
A kid, but I think this is an opportunity. I'm not happy Donald Trump got elected, but I think it's going to focus things. It's going to make people think a little bit less about small issues and a little bit more about big issues. And it's going to make people who are on the same side want to work together, or at least that's my hope.
I love that. And it's optimistic. And I agree. And I hope we do that. All right. We've got one more question Taylor is going to ask you.
All right, Mark, we wanted to end on a semi-fun one, and that was also a great optimistic note to end on, so thank
you. Yeah, that was fun. Anyway,
yeah.
Go ahead.
What do you think is the most important article that consumers and readers need but you haven't written yet?
The one that we just discussed, which
great.
I'm on the verge of writing. So
all right.
Well, we look forward to it.
We scooped you.
Yeah, you helped me scoop myself. It's fine.
Oh, all right. Awesome. Anything else, Taylor?
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
This has been so much fun, and I really want to thank you for your time and for coming on.
It was fun for me, too. And off the record or whatever.
Yeah.
We can do it anytime you want, especially if you don't make me come to Brooklyn. And
but there's pizza here.
I know. Well,
yeah, I know. There's pizza everywhere.
Yeah, that's
And I really, you know, they were great questions, so it really was fun. We can do it again if you want.
I love
I'd
that.
Love to.
Oh,
okay.
I'm going to keep that on the record and hold you to it.
Okay, fine.
All right, thanks, Mark. Okay, and that's our show for today. Want to thank Mark Bittman again so much for coming on the show, and a big thanks to our sponsors for your generous support. Our show is produced with the help from Taylor Lanzett, and show music is by Tim Archer. Thank you also to our engineer, David Tadashore, who is the best. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. Like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liu, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. There was nothing to say.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.